2, Magnavox record player in mint condition. In the world of pro hockey, listening to music by yourself with the lights dimmed and candles burning is something only guys who are outside the herd do, and I am doing it from the start. I had fought the Stars captain Brendan Morrow a lot prior to being his new teammate. He didn't like me before I walked into the dressing room, and he liked me even less after. He didn't like the attention I was taking away from him when I signed. He'd married his former teammate Guy Carboneau's daughter in 2002, and because he was the team leader, that meant she was tasked with being the leader in the wives' room, though fortunately she didn't have to set the standard for her mother-in-law, as Carboneau retired in 2000. Mike Modano is the hockey king of Dallas, which is sort of like being third string on the Dallas Community College football team in terms of public awareness. No one has chanted his name at MSG. Modano has certainly had a Hall of Fame career, and is very close with Brett Hull. I have an uneasy feeling when I think about Modano keeping things together in the dressing room, because this team is made up of a lot of guys who have that Texas I'm number one thing going on. Marty Turco, the goalie, is another Dallas big shot, and he doesn't like me either because of my taunting of Marty Brodeur, who, as far as I can tell, plays for a team 1,500 miles away. I do not mix well with this group. Except to my surprise, Steve Ott. Steve is a similar player to me, and while he hasn't had an impact on the league like I did during my time in New York, he's still very good at what he does. Nothing is off limits for Ott, and he'll say almost anything to get a guy off his game. He's the one guy I thought I definitely wouldn't get along with. I like Brad Richards as well, so 2 out of 39. If I was playing Texas Hold'em with that hand, I'd fold. It's over 100 degrees in Texas, and I'm hot all the time. And when I'm hot, I sweat. So I dust off one of my short pantsuits for a trip to Los Angeles and head for my seat at the back of the team plane. I know it's going to take everyone a minute to get used to the look, but maybe it will actually catch on with some of the guys in this cauldron of a place. The next thing I know, the other co-GM, Les Jackson, tells me I need to go home and change into something more manly, and that the plane will wait. Yes, the Dallas Stars couldn't handle a guy in a suit with short pants, so they spent thousands of extra dollars in rental fees for an airplane while they waited for me to change. I'd never seen this happen before, but then again, I'm the first to ever try it. Did I mention I looked great? I think I arrived in Dallas to a very passive-aggressive reception because of my relationship with Brett Hull. Some of my new teammates felt like Brett had showed some favoritism that I didn't merit. Well, that's exactly what happened. And if I were running a team, I'd try to sign as many players as I could who I had a previous relationship with and who I knew could step up and help the team. I'd want to know as much as I could about my players. And if I'd not only played with a guy, but lived with him, and we hadn't killed each other, I'd sure as hell take a shot at getting him when he was available. I didn't do a good enough job mourning my breakup with New York. In sports, you don't get to take as much time as you need to get over a relationship with a team. You're expected to forget about it in hours and get on with the next one as soon as you pull on the new jersey. Everyone knows that if you don't take enough time after a tough breakup, and if you get into a rebound relationship, it never lasts. I think I'm in a rebound relationship with Dallas, and fuck, do I miss New York. Going from MSG to the American Airlines Center is like the rock star playing sellout crowds in the capital of the world one day, and then playing the state fair where fried butter is a delicacy the next. It's like coming down off Adderall. I feel tired and depressed and anxious and irritable. I hate it here. I hated it from the first game. I miss taking the subway to the arena before the game in my fresh pressed Prada suit and my scuffed up boots. I missed walking through the crowded restaurants, passing tables filled with people who were there because they were the best at what they did, from supermodels to fashion designers to actors to bankers to filmmakers and even to the teamsters who hauled our gear. I missed getting into a yellow cab and pulling up to the Beatrice Inn after a game. This was my life, and now I'm in Dallas eating barbecue ribs and watching a bunch of rich kids pretending to be cowboys throwing darts while tacky blondes drink martinis and talk about their upcoming trips to New York. On October 20th, I played my first game back at MSG, and we're in town for 5 whole days because we're also playing the Devils and the Islanders. And it's Fashion Week in New York, which means some fun stuff will be going on day and night, in addition to all the rest of the fun stuff, in case I needed reminding. I decided I didn't want to stay in the team hotel in Times Square, so I booked a room at the Mercer in Soho. The Mercer is my favorite hotel in New York. 6 stories of elegant Romanesque revival in the heart of one of the city's most interesting neighborhoods. It's the sister hotel to, ta-da, the Chateau Marmont in L.A. Brad Richards also wanted to have some freelance fun and joined me downtown with a room of his own. Technically, this wasn't allowed, but as long as you show up to the rink on time, it really doesn't matter. I know Richie made up his mind that he's getting out of Dallas when his contract runs out with the Stars, and he has his sights set on signing with the Rangers. So, he wanted to see what the city was really like. It was the perfect opportunity to show him around a bit, and not at the tourist spots that you'd see when you came as a visitor. Usually you land in a city and spend most of your time in the hotel when you're not at the rink. And then, before you know it, you're sitting on the plane getting ready to land in the next city. Life on the road is not that glamorous, but that doesn't count when you're in NYC. We beat the Rangers 2-1 at MSG. I'm a pro, so I did what I'm supposed to do. I put on my Sean Avery character face and went out of my way to get into goalie Henrik Lundqvist's space and talk shit to the talented young Brandon Dubinsky in warm-up. I wasn't happy. Beating the team that I still wanted to play for was not a great feeling. Richie is a good guy, a smart guy, and he was a total professional. He'd been focused on being a great NHLer for a long time, and now he was starting to enjoy himself a little bit more. Still, he was naive about what fame as a professional athlete could bring you. After the game, Richie and I took 2 dates to dinner at the Waverly Inn, and when we got back to the Mercer, I lit a fire in the wood-burning fireplace in my room, and we all went down to the lobby for a drink. 15 minutes later, the fire alarm goes off, and as hotel guests start filing into the lobby, the hotel manager approaches me and says, "Mr. Avery, you lit a fire in your room but forgot to open the flue." I wanted to set New York on fire again, but not literally. Being back in town gave me the chance to check in with Matt Abramchik and our new sports bar in Tribeca called Warren 77, which was coming along nicely. One of the reasons we ended up in Tribeca was that the rent was still manageable, and a restaurant's lease is what makes or breaks it. We'd have soft lighting with dark colors like Hunter Green, and the banquettes would be the classic red pleather with some pretty special art on the walls. Some Diane Arbus and a Warhol of Gretzky that I loaned the bar. I was really excited about this world I was creating outside hockey, and was confident that it would yield some security for when I hung up the skates. I knew I would be living back here in New York no matter what. But on I went with Dallas. I think the first real turning point that marked the beginning of my end with the Stars came on November 1st, 2008 in Boston. I've never seen 2 players turn an arena upside down like Steve Ott and I did that night. It was just one of those games that's nasty from the start. There were 146 minutes of penalties in that game. I had 21. Ott had 18, and the Bruins tried to get us suspended. They said the timekeepers who sit in the penalty box have never heard such disgusting language or obscene talk in 35 years of NHL hockey. Being an effective agitator is about being original, so I took that as a compliment. They forgot to mention the 2 train wrecks of girls who somehow got down to the penalty box area and started calling us faggots and asking us if it felt good to fuck each other's assholes. We felt obliged to respond. I always found it interesting when women wore jerseys with player names on the back to the game, as these ladies had done in Boston. We asked them, how does your boyfriend feel knowing that his girlfriend would blow Phil Kessel after the game in his fucking car? One of the girl's boyfriends came down to try talking shit back to us. So we asked him if she was allowed to blow Kessel so long as she brings home an autographed stick. He lasted about 17 seconds, then bailed 10 rows back up to his seat. He knew what we said was, if not literally true, then at least her fantasy, and he didn't want to go there. It was a nasty game from the get-go, with Chippy playing questionable hits and just a miserable kind of vibe in the barn in Boston. We lost 5-1, and I scored our only goal. After the game, Mike Modano actually said that we'd created a circus, and he had no interest in playing in a game that was as rough and testy an environment as the one caused by Avery and Ott. From day one of my time on Dallas, Modano was pissed off that they were paying me that much money, and he was pissed off that he wasn't making more. He was also coming to the end of his career and didn't like people who didn't roll out the red carpet for him as they once had. He was one of those supremely talented players who didn't work hard in practice and didn't backcheck and was as soft as a baby's ass. He didn't lay his body on the line for the team. He was also very close to Brett Hull, and since Hully and I were also close, I think he was a bit jealous. I knew my Dallas days were numbered. Hockey's evil genius. That's what the Hockey News called me when they put me on their May 13th, 2008 cover with devil's horns and a mustache and goatee drawn with a Sharpie over my face. So before we landed in Calgary on December 1st, 2008, the Canadian media had been hyping this big game against Calgary because of my growing reputation in the NHL, combined with the fact that Alicia Cuthbert, my ex-girlfriend of a year and a half, had started dating Dion Phaneuf, the star player of the Calgary Flames. I had certainly been in love with Alicia, but the fact that she'd moved on with her life after we split, as I had done, and was dating Phaneuf was not the least bit upsetting. What bothered me was that the Canadian media not only thought that this was actually an interesting storyline, but that they also thought it was an acceptable story. As well, there was a perfect storm brewing because I was miserable in Dallas, except for a brief surge of happiness every second Friday when we got paid and my paycheck was even bigger than I'd imagined because Texas has no state income tax. But the pleasure of the paycheck was fleeting. I wasn't having fun. Cameras, print, TV, cell phone were waiting in front of our hotel before we left for morning skate. I walked out to get one of the best things Canada has to offer, a coffee and a donut, or two, from Tim Hortons. The media horde immediately started asking me about Dion. I am astonished that the news day is so slow that this is the story they want to follow. How another NHLer is dating a woman I used to date. They really want to make this seem like some kind of bitter rivalry between me and Phaneuf. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe there's a way to play this, so I get inside his head before the game. But it's just a vague thought. Cameras were inside the arena and following my every movement in our morning skate, and now I'm annoyed. There are things going on in the world that are way more important than this. I mean, a million times more important. And I'm kind of embarrassed for these guys that this is what they wake up in the morning to do. I get off the ice, and the media is standing in the dressing room in a huddle, just waiting for me to invite them over. I walk into the trainer's room, and the guys are all laughing about how I have become the biggest story in Calgary. And then it happens. I say, I just want to comment on how it's become like a common thing in the NHL for guys to fall in love with my sloppy seconds. I have no idea why I used that term other than it's the most relevant slang I could think of for the situation. And my aim was to poke Dion Phaneuf before the game and get him mad at me. Brad Richards had said, you won't do it. Excuse me, but was that a challenge? So I walked out of the trainer's room and into the dressing room and spoke to the media, and the rest is history. Of course, it didn't seem that way at first. I got dressed and could feel that my teammates were playing it off like it was just another soundbite and an 82-game schedule. I got on the team bus to go back to the hotel for our lunch and pregame nap, and then it started. Guys' phones are buzzing and pinging, And when I walk into the lunchroom, all eyes are on me. Everyone already knows, including the coaches sitting at a table eating and looking at me like I've just ruined Christmas. I can hardly eat. I can't stop thinking about what I just said and what the suits at the NHL are going to bring down on me now. It was trash talk before a game, and what's the worst that can happen? The NHL will find me and that's the end of it? I walk into my hotel room and turn on the TV, and I'm on every channel. And just like in the movies, the phone rings, and on the other end is my friend and my boss, Brett Hall, who says, "Holy shit, you really did it this time." The great thing about Holly is that he always said what he thought, and by now, I was thinking the same thing. We knew each other well enough that when he said, "Get out of this shitstorm ASAP, just pack up and fly to New York, and we'll figure this out," we both knew my time in Dallas was over. He hadn't suspended me or anything like that. He was trying to protect me from what we both knew was about to happen, though it was worse than we imagined. As I sat on the tarmac waiting for my flight to leave for New York, I felt shame and relief. I felt like shit for embarrassing Alicia, which was certainly not my intention. I was in love with her once, and it didn't work out, but she's a great person, and we had a wonderful year and change together. Just to make it clear here, I am very sorry for causing her any distress at all. That was never my intention. I was just trash-talking FNUF, but I missed the target. I also feel a heavy burden of shame and disappointment in myself that I let my childhood idol down. Brett Hall was a guy who did nothing but good things for me when he didn't have to do anything. Other than my parents, nobody has done more for me than Brett Hall. And now I'd embarrassed the team he managed in a way that could affect his life. On the other hand, I was so relieved to be on a plane home, back to the place that feels safe and that inspires me every day. It's funny how, even more so today, if I haven't done my workout, shower, shave, and then dress by 9 a.m., I feel so guilty and embarrassed because by 9 a.m. in NYC, the streets are filled with people who've been on the grind for 3 hours. And I think if they see me walking to the gym at 9:30, it makes me look weak, like I have nothing to do. It's a bit crazy, but I love it. For the next few days, my comments were the talk of the sports world, more so than if I had murdered someone, NFL, beaten my wife, MLB, been drunk and brawling with the public, NBA, sometimes with guns. All of the above. I had many conversations with my agent Pat Morris and the NHLPA about just what the fuck I was thinking. And of course, I hadn't been thinking. I'd been reacting. All of our conversations were about interpreting the rules in case Dallas wanted to void my contract, which they couldn't do. They could suspend me, but we all thought it would be for a game or two as a kind of public relations gesture. I mean, I hadn't put a guy in the morgue. But no, the NHL suspended me indefinitely, in accordance with the provisions of Bylaw 17 and Article 6 of the NHL Constitution for conduct detrimental to the league or game of hockey. They set a hearing date where I would throw myself on the mercy of Bettman and his court. And I had little support from the Stars. I completely support the league's decision to suspend Sean Avery, Stars owner Tom Hicks said. Had the league not suspended him, the Dallas Stars would have. This organization will not tolerate such behavior, especially from a member of our hockey team. We hold our team to a higher standard and will continue to do so. Marty Turco got in on it too. It's just so disappointing for guys who have been around here for a long time and have taken a lot of pride in how this organization has been perceived. The disrespect of this morning and other things over the course of the season have been extremely disappointing for us. It's a slap in the face. Even John Tortorella said, "I was an embarrassment to the league," a comment that would soon be a very rich piece of irony. But right now, this was the perfect opportunity for everyone who hated Sean Avery to crush me. You'd think I was a repeat offender of some crime, but actually, I had not been suspended by the NHL prior to this incident. despite what my agent and the NHLPA said, there was still some talk that the Stars were going to try and tear up my contract. But I knew the NHLPA would never let that happen, because setting that type of precedent would change sports forever. I mean, if they could rip up my deal because I said something vulgar, then the owners might as well just put us all on golden leashes because no contract would be safe. I had my friend Billy Durney, head of security for the Olsen Twins, pick me up at my West 19th Street apartment and drive me to the NHL offices and walk me into the hearing, just in case anyone was out front to cause me a problem, but mostly to put on a show. Basically, the NHLPA said that my only shot at escaping the guillotine was to kiss the little man's ring, the little man being the second most hated person in hockey after me, Gary Bettman. I told Brett Hall to stay in Dallas and let me do this, because I wanted Brett to distance himself from me as much as he could. Brett is a loyal motherfucker, and really doesn't give a crap what anyone says about him. He'd also scored 700 NHL goals, and was NHL royalty, so he came with me. We walked into this fancy conference room at NHL headquarters, and everyone took their seats. The NHL's Minister of Justice, Colin Campbell, played the clip of me saying what I had said to the media in Calgary. He must have played it 20 times. He played it in slow motion again and again, like they were trying to find the second gunman in the JFK assassination. The NHL had at least a six-pack of lawyers in the room, and they walked us through all my prior incidents. There was the recent game in Boston. I scored a goal, made some hits, got in a fight, and the time I scuffled with Darcy Tucker in warm-up, and the time I called out visor-wearing French players for running guys, and the time I told Brian Hayward that he was a hack when he played and a hack on TV after he said he'd like to see me beaten to a pulp. That's right. A TV commentator advocated extreme violence against a professional athlete. I mean, in the history of the NHL, there had been far worse things than this, but that wasn't the point. They wanted me gone. It was a kangaroo court. These guys had been blowing hot air, and the only way I could get out of there with a job in the NHL was to blow some back. The difference being, what I said was true. Cue the music. I talked about being the small kid on the team, the guy who was always told that he was too short to play in the NHL, and how, when I finally made it after clawing my way in, I started to become a man who had interests away from the rink, catching up on all those things that junior hockey takes away from you. I told them I liked to read and to listen to music at home and at concerts, and that I liked art and design and fashion. And because I liked these things and was different from your typical NHLer, I had endured years and years of abuse from NHL fans and opposing players. They called me a faggot and held up signs in visiting arenas that called me a fag. And when I'd bang on the glass and point out the offending signs to the game officials, they did nothing. Cue the tears, which were real, because I was feeling frustrated by the sham of a hearing in which I wasn't being heard. But I told them that certainly, yes, the words I used to taunt Phaneuf could have been chosen better. Then I tried to flip the script on the NHL and blame them for not protecting me against this abuse directed at my assumed homosexual preference, even though the women I dated were regular tabloid fodder. Did the NHL suspend star Eddie Belfour when he had to be pepper sprayed in a Dallas hotel and offered the cops $1 billion? What about Kevin Stevens, who was arrested with crack cocaine and a hooker? What about Danny Heatley, who was convicted of vehicular homicide after killing my friend Dan Snyder? What about all those players who called Willie O'Ree the first black man to play in the NHL, the N-word? Nothing. I was trying my best to not get the death penalty. As I walk out of the NHL offices, I have no idea what fate awaits me. And then I get the call. I've been suspended for 6 games and sentenced to 30 days in a Malibu, California rehab facility. Hold on a second. Did they just say rehab? What the fuck could I possibly be going to spend a month in a rehab facility for? I hardly ever drink, and other than the occasional joint, I don't do drugs. Is this a joke? No, The NHL's Council of Wizards have determined that I have anger issues, and so I will go to rehab for anger management. Chapter 19. Down and out and back again. The few days I had to wait before flying to Los Angeles, business class paid for by the NHL, but still to rehab, were just like waiting to go to the big house. I had lost my liberty, just for a month. But even so, I was worried that I would lose my livelihood. And what would await me in rehab? People who should be there most likely, unlike me. I land in LA, and my old friends Lawrence Longo and Cody Leibel pick me up at the airport, and we all head to In-N-Out before we make the drive to Malibu. We're cracking jokes, and the mood is light. I'm not really nervous. My fate has been decided. So, now it's time to embrace the ride. We wind our way into a canyon in Malibu. And I think about the first time I came to this part of the world, to Chris Chelios' beach party, which seems like an age ago. Finally, we pull into a driveway, no gates or barbed wire, and park in front of a beautiful house with a pool in the backyard. I gave the guys a hug and they drove off. Rehab has a name, and it's called The Canyon. It opened in 2004, and it's big. A 4,000-square-foot main house with clusters of cottages spread over 240 acres. It has a cool view of the surrounding Santa Monica Mountains and the Pacific Surf beyond. There are 2 8-bed facilities, one for women and one for men. You have a roommate, but the rooms are big, have fireplaces, 4-poster beds, and sheets with a very high thread count. And so it should be a little deluxe, as it costs $58,000 for a 30-day visit. I can tell that the people running the canyon, very professional and welcoming, are confused by my situation, since they don't run me through the normal search before check-in. It's 10:45 p.m., and as it's been a long day, I head to bed. My roommate is already sleeping. He wakes up in the middle of the night, coming down from whatever substance has landed him here, and is jumping up and down on his bed. I have to try to calm him down until staff can arrive. He's older, pushing 70, and he's won Emmys and an Oscar. And I didn't know who he was until the fourth day when one of the workers told me. He was in for an addiction that he'd been trying to manage for many years. And he was certainly a calming influence on me over the next while. Why I'm here, I still can't figure out. Life at the canyon is all about routine. I wake up early, around 7 a.m., and have breakfast. The food is great, except there is no sugar, and that is something to which I am definitely addicted. I have a trainer from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. every morning in the gym. Then I take part in group therapy, and it's heavy shit. Crack addiction and sexual abuse cases. I share my story, and everyone looks at me like I'm making a joke of this place. No, I wasn't raped by my uncle from ages 4 to 14. And no, I don't cut or starve myself. I'm not an alcoholic, and I've never tried cocaine. And I'm taking up the place of someone who might really need to be here, like the people in my group. Was the NHL out of its mind? The only contact I have from the outside world is via NHLPA doctors, who observed the process. I knew that I was going to have to do my time here. But I also knew that once all the smoke cleared, it would all work itself out. I realize now that subconsciously, when I made the sloppy seconds comment, I was trying to get myself back to New York. I wanted to make something happen. I wanted to get traded. I had just picked a very hard way of going about it. And as I said, I'm very impulsive and don't always think things through. This was certainly an awakening for me. For while I thought the reason I was in rehab was ridiculous and demeaning to the people who really needed to be here, my journey at the canyon did help me to understand myself better as a person. The focus of treatment, mindfulness, ends up being a wonderful tool that I still use. Mindfulness is about controlling your impulses, using your breath, just hearing your breath as you inhale and exhale, and just remembering to breathe. It really works. I've been in the canyon for 21 days, and Christmas is a week away, and I'm starting to lose it. I feel that the people who are here really need to be here. And I feel sorry for many of them, who have none of the outside support that I have. But I am done. Dr. Dan Cronin, who is a clinical psychologist and the NHL's substance abuse expert, and Dr. Brian Shaw, the NHLPA's guy, are the joint decision makers in this process. I think both psychologists know I'm at my breaking point and that I'm starting to think about packing my bags despite the potential consequences. I think both guys know I've done everything they asked during my time here, and clearly I don't have a problem that would put my health at risk by leaving early, so they cut me loose. On my way out the door, I'm hit by a cool blast of reality. It's clear that I'm not going back to Dallas. Medano and Turco and Coach Dave Tippett, who hated me, have issued an ultimatum to Hully, and it's 3-1 at least. I'm done in Dallas. And yet, I'm still the NHL-caliber player that I was a month ago. And when you take a step back and look at this fairly, you realize I didn't break the law. I made a distasteful comment. It's true. Though, if the NHL is worried about levels of distasteful, the execs should hang around dressing rooms more. As my plane takes off for Manhattan, I have one question bashing around inside my head. How do I get back into a New York Ranger jersey? I know I will make this happen. And after a month in California, I need to go back to boot camp to make my NHL return a success. Pat Minocchia is a former hockey player from Brown University who owns La Palestra, a gym on Central Park West. It's based on the ancient Greek idea of the gymnasium, and with its elegant colonnades, it is a thing of beauty. Pat trains Madonna, Howard Stern, Julia Roberts, John McEnroe, and Liam Neeson, and has a magic touch with people who need to look good for their jobs. I need to look good for my job because sooner rather than later, I'm going to get the call. In warm weather, Central Park is a runner's paradise. But in January, it's a nightmare. Some paths would be better navigated on ice skates. The distance from La Palestra around the upper reservoir of the park is 2 miles. Some parts of the loop are open to the major winds that whip through the canyons of Manhattan. And other than the odd winter warrior out running, the only company I have are the tips of the skyscrapers lining the perimeter of Central Park. I use them as motivation. I've just witnessed what happens when I don't have this city. So every time it feels too cold to continue, I look at the buildings and I dig in. Every time I look around and think there's nobody here to see if I only do one lap instead of two, I look at those buildings staring down at me and I do 2 laps. I will not let this story have a bad ending. I finally get the call that I've been willing the universe to make. Glenn Sather wants to meet for lunch. And obviously this is not because he's hungry. Glenn is sniffing out a deal, and Dallas knows that they have no leverage. The only option they have is to send me down to the minors and recall me when they have word from a team that wants to claim me on re-entry. Dallas played its hand when it sent me home, and the Stars' righteous owner, Tom Hicks, said he doesn't want anyone of my low character on his team. Hicks would default on more than $500 million in loans a year later. In 2011, he took the Dallas Stars to bankruptcy. In 2016, his son, Tommy Jr., was one of Donald Trump's biggest fundraisers. Yes, a family of top-notch character that I was a fool not to model mine on. I felt bad for Hully that I put him in this situation, but Dallas management put him in an even worse one. The reality is that the team that claims me can get me at half price, and Dallas will be on the hook for the other half. Glenn Sather gets me cheaper than what he offered me for as a free agent, and I'm back in New York making twice as much as I would have had I taken Glenn's original offer. It's starting to look like I've pulled off a fucking miracle. Glenn Sather loves the action. And he loves the art of a deal. He loves doing things that others won't do. He's what you call a player's GM. Because for the most part, he doesn't bullshit you. Glenn is wearing his usual dapper sports coat with sweater and shirt to match. He reportedly makes $8 million a year. But like all rich people, he loves free stuff. He started to get free stuff from a men's clothing company called Robert Graham. And he's rocking the shit out of these duds. He also has his signature piece, a cigar he never lights but holds in his mouth till it disappears. Where the fuck did it go? The guys have asked hundreds of times before. Glenn has been given the keys to the Rangers by his longtime friend, and in my opinion, the best owner in sports, James Dolan. Sure, Dolan inherited his money, but he's actually aware of that, and he's great to his players in terms of providing a climate that allows us to do what we do to the best of our abilities. I know my new message is change, and I will hammer it home to Glenn. I will be honest that I fucked up, but that I need to get back to New York and help his team win. The amount of love I have from Ranger fans is immense. And I also have support from the face of the franchise, Henrik Lundqvist. Part of what makes Hank great is that he's a little bit oblivious to what goes on in the world around him. So he hasn't really been following my public whipping in any great detail. When I said to him, if I can get it to the point where they'll take me back, will you stand up for me? He said yes. Glenn doesn't call Hank before he makes a move, but he and everyone else in the organization know that my relationship with the star goalie is strong. We both have a love of fashion, and we initially bonded over that. We play the game at the same level of intensity and respect that in each other. We were also the only Rangers who had their names chanted at the Garden, and I admired the fact that he was the most well-endowed teammate I had ever seen, by a considerable margin. I think Glenn had already made up his mind before we met at Nick and Steph's steakhouse, right next to MSG. Because otherwise, why would he meet me in the middle of the day in a busy NYC restaurant, right next to the rink where everyone knows my name? He knew I was going to say all the right things. And he also knew I was still the same guy he'd offered a multi-year deal to 6 months earlier. I think it was a bonus that the guy he was meeting with had changed a bit. And the only thing that was different about this convo from most of the others I had with Glenn was when he noticed the new tattoo on my forearm. You used to be all right. What happened? This tattoo was a reminder to use the mindfulness technique I had recently learned at the Canyon. It's a lyric from my favorite Radiohead song, 15 Step. So thanks, Gary Bettman. Rehab really did change me. Without it, I wouldn't have this tattoo, among other things. We agreed I would go to Hartford for 2 weeks, and if the reports came back positive, then I would be back in a Ranger jersey. Holy shit, I'm going to pull this off. To be honest, my 2 weeks in Hartford felt longer than my 3 weeks in rehab. Part of this is due to just how fast your body can get out of game shape when you're not playing, and how much work it takes to get your legs and timing back. And part of this is the fact that the Hartford coach, Ken Jernander, is a total tool. Or maybe he thinks I am, and that's why he treats me like he has to hold his nose around me. I can see how it must seem. I'm a pampered NHLer who ran afoul of the league, got sent to some posh rehab clinic, and am now finishing my cleanup here in Hartford, and he's running a hockey team, not a clinic. But I know that just like the Canyon, I'm not here forever, so I make it work. It wasn't a situation where I'd beaten up my granny, so the players in Hartford and around the league were excited to play with me or against me. Even so, I keep my head down in the dressing room and up on the ice. I play 8 games, get 2 goals and an assist, and get sentenced to just 8 minutes in the penalty box. Slats can see that I meant what I said. Ken Jernander calls me into his office after practice one cold morning, at the top of March, to tell me that Dallas is putting me on re-entry and that New York is going to claim me. Tomorrow I'll be back at MSG, so I better get going. I pack my bags and turn the engine on in my Audi S8, and the roar of the fastest sedan on planet Earth replicates the sound of my game the moment I step foot on the ice of MSG. On February 23rd, 2009, Slats fired coach Tom Rennie. The Rangers had been on a losing skid, 10 losses in 12 games, and as usually happens, the coach got the blame. Rennie had a long run with the Rangers, and I liked him. He hadn't been a player, but he started out as a junior hockey coach in Kamloops, British Columbia, and had been successful. He knew how to talk to players, and he could teach us stuff. Sather thinks the Rangers, who were in first place for a good chunk of the early season, need a kick in the ass. And that kick would be coming from John Tortorella, who piled on me for my sloppy seconds remark when he was working as a TV analyst after he got fired by Tampa. At the news conference announcing his hiring, Slats had to address the elephant in the room, which was me. I think over time, he, Tortorella, will learn to love him, me, like we do. It's nice of Slats to go out on a limb for me. But he isn't, not really. He's the boss, and he's telling everyone, especially Tortorella, how it's going to be. He thinks I can help the team, he's happy with my price, and that's it. Tortorella didn't quite get Glenn's message. After my first meeting with Tortorella, I knew that he meant every word when he'd called me an embarrassment on TV. Our meeting was very one-sided, and he wanted me to know that this was his show, and I was going to become a faceless piece of the puzzle if I was going to play on his team. It was like a chihuahua barking at a German shepherd. The little dog wants to make the big dog know that he's the boss. He wasn't yelling. He was just in a position to reaffirm his manhood in a room where you couldn't backtalk, and I would learn that he loved to do that. I have no problem being a team player, but let's be honest. New York is a market where it's impossible to have a team of anonymous soldiers. I have a history with this city and this team, and the fans weren't chanting Tortorella's name at MSG. They were chanting mine. I say all the right things during the meeting, and I'm willing to put the things he said about me behind us because I understand he was an unemployed coach trying to make a living as a loudmouth, abrasive TV analyst. Maybe we actually have some things in common. He says he's going to make me a better player, and I'm happy to go along on that journey. I played my first game back with the Rangers on March 5th, 2009. We beat the Islanders, then we beat Boston, lost to Carolina, and I got my first goal against Nashville in a 4-2 win for us. After the Islanders game, which was on Long Island, and where the fans welcomed me back by booing me all night, a reporter from the Daily News asked me if I'd been nervous before the game. If there were any nerves coming in, I certainly got rid of them quick, I told him. After the Nashville win, a reporter asked me how it felt to be scoring again. Great, I said. One of the secrets of the locker room is that we want to tell the beat reporters who we love and see as teammates the kind of stuff they can't really print. So my fantasy answer would have gone like this. Beat writer, Sean, you really came out of the gates flying in that first period. Can you tell us why? Me. It's funny, because when I got to the rink tonight, I felt like shit. And when I came out for warm-up, I saw this super hot Russian model with big heavy C-cups standing two rows behind our bench with her agent Craig, who's a personal friend, and all of a sudden, my legs felt like rocket launchers and I played possessed. When the puck bounced off my ass and into the net, I felt like I had a real shot at her. Beat writer, do you think you can carry it over to tomorrow's game? Me. Honestly, all I care about right now is getting all these stupid interviews done with and putting on my $3,000 Tom Ford suit and taking Anna with the heavy C-cups to Mr. Chow and then hopefully be done fucking her brains out by 1:30 a.m. so I can watch Homeland on DVR and get a few hours sleep before morning skate. I've always wanted to give that interview, but if I'd done it when I was playing, I would have been sent to the canyon permanently. I finished the season playing 19 games for the Rangers and my new coach, John Tortorella. I scored 5 goals, added 7 assists, and served only 30 minutes in the penalty box, which is a hell of a run considering the circumstances I came back from. Tortorella put me up on the first line, and I worked as hard as I've ever worked, and we made the playoffs. When I said I was excited to play for John Tortorella and thought he was going to make me a better player, I believed it because he said he would, and while I thought he was many things, liar was not one of them. Going into the first round series against Washington, though, I was scratching my head. This coach really doesn't like me, because the better I play, the less he plays me. And I've always believed my gut doesn't lie. I know what's going on here. When the team isn't playing well, he promotes me to the first line, and when they do, he buries me on the fourth. It's part of his strategy to show me in the worst possible light. So when he says to Slats, this Avery isn't working out, it will look like he's telling the truth. My game has lost something under Tortorella's regime. I feel tentative. We're expected to dump and chase, and the creativity has been sucked out of the Rangers game. Scott Gomez is the only player allowed to make a creative play, with the risk that if he blows it, it could end up on a Washington stick. The rest of the team plays with our assholes so tight we whistle as we skate. We sit in our stalls more exhausted from the constant negativity coming from the coaches over our shoulders than from the war we're fighting on ice. We win the first two games on the road, lose the next one at home, and then win game four. We're up 3-1 on Washington, and all we have to do is win one more, and we're through to the next round. Then Tortorella benches me for game five. It's punishment for taking two penalties in the third period in our 2-1 win in game four. He tells the media that I crossed an emotional line and put the team in trouble. So he's sitting one of his most effective guys to make him learn the lesson to play like a zombie. I watched the game from the box and the Rangers lose 4-0. Washington scored less than 5 minutes in, and that was all they needed. I'm back in the lineup for game six in MSG, and Tortorella is suspended. While I was in the press box in game five, he completely lost his mind and squirted water at fans in Washington, then threw a water bottle that hit a lady in the head, and for a while, brandished a hockey stick until Jim Schoenfeld, an assistant coach, restrained him. That's right, that Jim Schoenfeld, the one who triggered a referee strike by getting into it with ref Don Koharski and telling him to have another donut, you fat fucking pig. If you're keeping track, the assistant coach, who had been suspended for losing his cool, had to restrain the head coach who was suspended for losing his cool. And I was the one sent to rehab for anger issues. But at least Schoenfeld put me back in the lineup, and I get an assist on our first goal, which ties the game at one. And I stay out of the box for 60 minutes. We lose 5-3. Now the Caps have tied the series, and Game 7 is winner take all. We score first, and I get another assist. Washington ties it, and then, with less than 5 minutes left in the third period, I watch Sergei Fedorov raising his arms after making Wade Redden look like the worst free agent signing in the last 20 years. We lose 2-1. We lost the series where we'd been up 3-1. That doesn't happen to good teams, especially when you have a goalie like Lundqvist in your net. Nice work, Torts. Tortorella has a reputation as a hard ass, but not if you know him as a player. We used to laugh at him all the time. There was always someone in the dressing room who wanted to take their skate and decapitate him, or take their stick and whack him over the head with it. Marian Gaborik despised him with every bone in his body. Even Hank Lundqvist, an even-keeled Swede who was usually in his own world, thought Tortorella was a terrible manager of pro athletes. Andy can't skate and stick handle a puck at the same time, and he doesn't realize we really don't take him seriously because of that. I thought Tortorella was a clown, but he was hardly the first coach I didn't respect. But there were two things he did that season that made me think he was a danger to the team. First, he referred to our fans at MSG as idiots. He said it with hate. I wanted to stand up and bitch slap him. What does this midget who can't even skate know about the MSG fans? How hard they've cheered for us ever since I've worn this jersey, and how hard they cheered for us the last 2 years in the playoffs. How they make us feel special when we walk down the street in a big city like New York. I can guarantee that I wouldn't ever bump into Tortorella on the street because he didn't even live in New York City. And then he called our local beat writers fucking idiots. The hockey beat writers are always there, writing about our team no matter what, win or lose. Our writers give us presence and identity in a city crowded with pro sports teams. And as players, we need it. The confidence you get from a headline that has your name in it and an article that praises you is almost as valuable as the kick in the butt you get from an article that calls you out for not playing well and makes you realize you really need to pick up your game ASAP. And now our coach is degrading these writers as idiots. He thought these big city writers whose profession was to follow our team and the game we played didn't have a clue about hockey. The funny thing is that Tortorella can skate just about as well as some of our beat writers. Over the summer prior to the 2009-2010 Rangers training camp, Tortorella kept in touch with me by phone, and the calls were very weird. I actually liked the idea of coaches speaking to their players during the offseason, but these calls felt more like he was pretending to give a shit about what I was doing, when really he was spying on me. He'd ask me whether I was working hard and getting ready for camp. He could have asked any staffer on the Rangers, trainers, conditioners, or Glenn if conditioning had ever been an issue. But no, and he also seemed to be very interested in where I was. Might I be in Paris, south of France, Croatia? He always asked my GPS so that he could make it seem like I was in all the places where every other serious hockey player wasn't. And nor was I. Tortorella was just trying to get evidence to make me look like a loser to Slats, when the real loser was the guy that Tort saw in the mirror. In May 2009, I walked into the first precinct of the NYPD in Tribeca and asked to speak with the station chief. Yankees, Rangers, Jets, Mets, Giants, and Knicks are like gods with the boys in blue, because cops love sports and they love their local teams. It's in their DNA. I introduced myself to everyone and explained that I had a sports bar opening that night around the corner and that they were very welcome to come around and say hello. Now, the first rule for pro athletes and everyone else is do not get into the bar business. Of course, as a breaker of the rules, I decided to give it a try because after all, I had Matt Abramczyk as my partner and we were going to be different. Indeed, as we designed the layout on a napkin that first time we walked the space together, we were designing a sports bar that would be the first of its kind anywhere in the world. A sports bar so chic that on opening night, we had people spilling out onto Warren Street. The crowd was a mix of fashion heavy hitters, along with Yankees, Knicks, Jets, Rangers fans, and a lot of downtown cool kids. Henrik Lundqvist played guitar with his band, John McEnroe was in the house, and then someone special walked in. I was standing at the end of the bar smoking a cigarette after Hank had finished his set. We let VIPs smoke upstairs, and as co-owner, I rated. When she walked in, I'd never seen a more beautiful woman in my life, and my eyes had landed on a lot of beauty. She had long legs and a lean, toned body, and her face was perfection that God does not create very often. I leaned over to Juan, our manager, and said, "That's the woman I'm going to marry." He didn't laugh. Her name is Hillary Rhoda. She's 22, and she's from Chevy Chase, Maryland. She's the face of one of the biggest cosmetic brands in the world, Estee Lauder, and a Sports Illustrated swimsuit model. She is a creature I have only seen before in the movies. I never put the moves on a woman whom I find attractive when I first meet her. I always wait until our energy brings us together for a second time, and I always play it cool. That's my move. But tonight, Hillary walked into Warren 77 with a mutual friend, Christina, who I suddenly became very interested in talking to, and shut out the rest of the party happening around us. Christina can see how mesmerized I am by Hillary, and like a good friend, she breaks away to give me a chance to hang with my future wife. At the end of the night, I shake Hillary's hand and tell her it was really nice to meet her, and that I cannot wait to see her again. Later that night, I send her a text. Christina gave me her number to tell her how pretty I thought her dress was, perfect for the summer. Or the rest of our lives. I did not tell her that, but she texted me back and said it would be great to see me again. I smiled. My life in New York was suddenly looking better again. I hadn't been dating anyone since my return to New York, and certainly wasn't sampling from the parade of puck bunnies who circle teams from junior hockey onward. Hockey has its own slang that captures the spirit of the game, playing heavy, which means not cutting corners in your game, foot on the gas, which means going full tilt on the ice, and puck bunnies, which is a kinder term for jock sniffers. And both of which refer to groupies. Groupies are part of any sports or entertainment culture, and in hockey they start in junior, especially if you're playing in Canada. That's when they're called puck bunnies, and it's not really a term of endearment. You don't want your sister to be called one. The puck bunnies go to places where players hang out, like hockey rinks and hockey bars, which in small town Canada is pretty much any bar in town. Some bunnies would even go to team meet and greets in malls. Some would go to the get to know the season ticket holder party, where you'd skate with the season ticket holders and then host a luncheon and they'd ask you questions. The hardcore bunnies would go to those events. The higher end puck bunnies were strategic about it. They'd suntan next to the spot where the Kings liked to play summer volleyball in Manhattan Beach, for example, and get invited to players' parties. In a small town like Owen Sound, Ontario, the puck bunny wasn't as good looking as the puck bunny in LA or New York. But then, when you hit the pros, they're not puck bunnies anymore. They're just groupies. I do not get turned on when I look into a woman's eyes and see that she is a fan, because having a fan surrender to me sexually doesn't get me going. I like the challenge of seduction. I like planning the approach, the introduction, the small talk that I try to turn into a conversation based on the energy of mutual attraction. This is where she starts laughing because I'm funny and not because she wore my jersey as a kid. I believe the lack of confidence is one of the main reasons athletes love jock sniffers. Before social media gave everyone instant intel on where you were or who you were with, hockey players would hang out at the same bars so that the ladies in the stands would know where to find them after games. Once I got traded to New York, I stopped going out on the road because it's all downhill after you've partied in New York, and the road became the only place I could get some sleep. Well, that's not quite true. One time when I was with the Kings, we were in a Montreal bar and the bartender, who was this gorgeous, black-haired French-Canadian lady, decided we'd get more privacy in the icebox. So we waltz into the cooler, aiming to heat it up a bit, and another teammate of mine was already in there, enjoying the hospitality of one of the waitresses. It was a big cooler, so the bartender just pulled me into a corner far from my busy teammate, and we got busy ourselves. My life in New York was suddenly looking better again. Falling in love with the girl of your dreams is cool. That's what's happening with Hillary, and I am playing it all fast forward. I think that being a loving husband is very cool, and being a loving father is the coolest. But that's down the road. Having a companion whom you're committed to should not end the fun. I've had many relationships over the years, and in between them, I would crank up my dating patterns and sometimes would crank them down, as I wanted to be alone. I certainly became much pickier as I got older, and the types of women I met changed when I moved to New York. Since the opening night of Warren 77, I couldn't stop thinking about the girl from Chevy Chase, Maryland, and I finally realized why my friends and teammates made fools of themselves for women. And then I picked up the phone and told Hillary to grab a friend, and I'd have a plane waiting for her on the tarmac in Farmingdale on Long Island to fly them to Bonnaroo. Bonnaroo was a music festival outside Nashville that a couple of friends from NYC started in 2002. My friends and I would fly to Nashville, and the bus would pick us up at the airport. We'd stop at Walmart and fill the bus with supplies, water, candy, lawn chairs, AstroTurf, and enough booze for a 100-person wedding. And our access was so VIP that we'd park the bus a few hundred feet from backstage. The first 2 years of Bonnaroo saw 10 buses parked backstage, but none of them prepared like we did, including the guys that started the festival. Over the years, our bus had some famous acts cruise through for a drink. Jimmy Buffett, MGMT, Jim James, and instead of coming in for a drink, Lily Allen, who grabbed a bottle of our Jägermeister and drove away on the back of a golf cart. I never imagined that I might get the chance to spend a weekend with my future wife at Bonnaroo. And even if you told me that it would cost $22,000, I wouldn't have blinked. Hillary got on that plane, and as we danced together among 90,000 strangers, I had to catch myself from staring at her too much so that I wouldn't freak her out. But more than look at her, I wanted to get to know this beautiful woman. What did she think? What did she hope? What did she want? I was going to find out everything I could about her and hope the conversation lasted a very long time. As the summer slid towards September, Hillary and I hung out less in groups of friends and started hanging out as a couple, which we weren't yet. and had not even been alone together until we sat at the table of our first proper date, Mr. Chow and Tribeca. One night in August, when I drove her home to Astor Place from my apartment on West 19th,